Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, back on this side of the pond, ladies and gentlemen, proud to say. Just stopping off to pick up my absentee ballot. I haven't mentioned this on the air because plenty of time to plug it when you can see it, but I've been spending the last 2 months of my life really deeply ensconced in the world of Richard M. Nixon. And so it was with some chagrin, my wife would want me to say, chagrin, I would want me to say, that I read a piece in New York Magazine by a former staff person, former White House something. I don't know her exact position, talking about her former boss. And the takeaway that I got from it was, he's a very private man. And the negative spin that some people put on that is, he doesn't like people. This is the incumbent we're talking about, ladies and gentlemen. Well, let's ignore the negative spin because that takes me straight into Nixon country. But so does the former. Why does a guy who's a very private man go into the business where the main job is to say, hey, how are you, a million times? We'll figure that out eventually, won't we? And now a new feature on this broadcast. It's a free country, ain't it?
It's a free country where dreams come true.
And a story to illustrate that. That very point. And it comes from Hawaii. Walter Hicks is a 34-year-old from Gulfport, Mississippi. He was stranded in Honolulu this week after being told he was on the FBI's no-fly list during a layover for a military flight from California to Japan. The episode left Hicks scrambling, says the AP, to figure out how he'd get home from Hawaii without being able to fly. Then he was abruptly removed from the list Thursday with no explanation. Presto changeo, you're free. It raised questions beyond how he landed on the list. How could someone on the list that intelligence officials used to inform counterterrorism investigations successfully fly standby on an Air Force flight? Hicks said he was traveling to visit his wife, a U.S. Navy lieutenant who was deployed in Japan. He hitched a ride on the military flight, common for military dependents, who are allowed to do that. He said during the layover at Pearl Harbor, Hicken Air Base, a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, an ICE man, told him he was on the no-fly list and would not be allowed on a plane. I said, how am I supposed to get off the island and go see my wife or go home? And her explanation was, I don't know. Hicks said he was shocked and thought they must have had the wrong person because he does not have a criminal record and recently passed an extensive background check in Mississippi to get a permit to carry a concealed weapon. Gets better. But the agent said his name, social security number, and date of birth matched the person prohibited from flying, according to Hicks. He was not told why and wondered whether his controversial views on the 9/11 attacks played a role. He said he disagrees with the commission's conclusion about the attacks. A Homeland Security spokesman referred questions to the FBI Terrorist Screening Center, which maintains the report. A spokesman for the center declined to comment. The government did not disclose who was on the list or why someone might have been placed on it or taken off, for that matter. The list can be updated within minutes, so it's possible Hicks was added to the list while he was in midair from Northern California to Hawaii. A spokesperson for Defense Secretary Panetta's office said passengers who fly standby in military flights are screened against the FBI's list only on international flights. It's scary to know that something like this can happen in a free country, said Hicks. You're not accused of any crime. You haven't been contacted by anyone. No investigation has been done. No due process has taken place, unquote. Apparently he didn't hear Attorney General Holder's speech about what due process constitutes these days. Doesn't guarantee judicial process, babe. He got a hotel room at the Pearl Harbor Naval Base while he worked things out. Being on the list, the no-fly list, did not stop him from staying the night on a base that is home to submarines, cruisers, and destroyers.
It's a free country where dreams come true.
It's a free country, ain't it? Hello, welcome to the show. the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, the home of the River Promise. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Very glad to be back in a country that's free enough that we can see ads for prescription drugs on our own TV sets, ladies and gentlemen. Can't stop that. But boy, it's the first, really one of the first things you realize that makes you realize I'm in a different place now. And now, some side effects for you.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
News of our friend the Atom. Addy, you working on your tan?
You jest. Cloudy.
I know. I did jest. Just a couple of items.
Thank goodness.
TEPCO, your friends at TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, operator of the Fuuk plant, now admits it had avoided taking some safety measures prior to the March 2011 nuclear accident. That's according to a new report.
It's just a report.
When looking back on the accident, the problem was that preparations were not made in advance, says the report prepared by a nuclear reform task force. That stance represents an about-face for TEPCO, which has maintained it had done its best to prevent an accident from occurring. Quote, there was a worry that if the company were to implement a severe accident response plan, that would be a plan in response to a severe accident, not a severe plan. This gentleman just making that clear because, you know, that if there were a severe accident response plan, it would spur anxiety throughout the country. Anxiety, and in the community where the plant is sited, and lend momentum to the anti-nuclear movement. That's from the committee's report. TEPCO announced the third-party committee September 11th to oversee the reform of its nuclear power division. The report said TEPCO admitted that some suggested safety improvements, such as using multiple power sources.
It's redundant.
And cooling systems would have involved closing the plant temporarily, thus adding to its costs. You see. Quote, it's very clear that mistakes were made, said Dale Klein, a committee member, former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and user of the passive voice. The committee's goal, he says, is to ensure that TEPCO develops practices and procedures so an accident like this will never happen again. Unquote. At least not there. Maybe.
Maybe.
Because an unredacted version of a recently released Nuclear Regulatory Commission report in this country highlights the threat that flooding poses to nuclear power plants located near large dams. Well, that would never happen. They don't need water to cool. And suggests that the NRC has misled the public for years about the severity of the threat, according to engineers and nuclear safety advocates. This is a report from the Huffington Post.
They report?
Yes, I decide. The redacted information shows that the NRC is lying to the American public about the safety of U.S. reactors, said David Lockbaum. He's with the Union of Concerned Scientists. A redacted version of the report.
He's in a union?
No. A redacted version of the report was posted to the NRC website on March 6th. An unredacted version was recently obtained by Greenpeace and shared with the Huffington Post.
That's a leak.
Among other things, evidence in the report indicates that the NRC has known for a decade or longer that failure of a dam upriver from the Oconee nuclear station in South Carolina would cause floodwaters to overwhelm the plant's three reactors and their cooling equipment, not unlike what happened at Fuuk. Three reactors at Fuuk experienced a full meltdown. Not a laughing matter. According to the NRC's own calculations, which were also withheld in the public version of the report released in March, the odds of the dam near the Oconee plant failing at some point over the next 22 years are far higher than were the odds of an earthquake-induced tsunami causing a meltdown at Fuuk.
Sounds like a good bet.
The NRC report identifies flood threats from upstream dams at nearly three dozen other nuclear facilities in the United States, including the Fort Calhoun Station in Nebraska, the Prairie Island facility in Minnesota, and the Watts Bar plant in Tennessee, among others. Advocates and engineers also contend that the NRC, by originally releasing only a heavily redacted version of the report, inappropriately invoked security concerns to mask embarrassing information. That never happens. This includes the full extent of the flood risk at Oconee, which is covered at greater length than the greatest length in the report, and the continued failure of regulators to require the facility's owner to swiftly improve the plant's defenses against flooding.
You cannot defend against floods. Ask the Army Corps of Engineers.
The first thing, the first piece of wisdom you've ever actually spoken, Addie.
Thank you.
Our friend the Adam. News of the Adam, ladies and gentlemen, clean, safe team. Now, in case you were wondering, yes, Joe the Plumber is running for Congress. As a matter of fact, here is one of his campaign ads.
In 1911, Turkey established gun control. From 1915 to 1917, 1.5 million Armenians, unable to defend themselves, were exterminated. In 1939, Germany established gun control. From 1939 to 1945, 6 million Jews and 7 million others, unable to defend themselves, were exterminated.
I love America.
That is actually a TV spot for Samuel Wurzelbacher, known when he first came to fame in the 2008 McCain campaign as Joe the Plumber. He's running as, need I say, as a Republican? He showed up at a debate with his opponent, U.S. Representative Marcy Kaptur, in Wednesday at a candidate night in Lorain, Ohio. You remember her. He had skipped a debate with his opponent last week at the Cleveland City Club, saying he had never received a call inviting him. A City Club spokesman said Wurzelbacher never responded to multiple attempts to get in touch with him. He says he's largely avoided the media, said he prefers to go door to door to meet with voters in person. He said he wants to avoid being misunderstood. He says voters know him as someone who speaks his mind. I haven't sold out. I haven't been bought, he said. And if I do get elected, I'll be the most honest candidate they've had. Unquote. Joe the Plumber. P.S. He's not a plumber.
If you need to know how much tax you owe,
go ask Joe the Plumber.
If you're wondering how to make your income grow,
go ask Joe the Plumber.
If you've got questions about the size of the debt, or how come only banks got the safety net, if your query hasn't been answered yet, you gotta ask Joe the Plumber. Joe, he's the one in the know, taking all of your gripes, but don't let him work on your pipes. Joe the Plumber loans about as large as a Hummer. Wish I'd known him back last summer. Joe the Plumber. If you've been stewing over how the climate's doing,
go ask Joe the Plumber.
If you'd like to stop all those lawyers suing,
go ask Joe the Plumber.
If your TV isn't getting HD and you want to see pay movies for free, don't ask Time Warner or NBC. Just ask Joe the Plumber. Joe. He's the star of the show. Feel free to tap into his brains, but don't let him work on your drains. Joe the Plumber, if he's in a band, he's the drummer. Makes Obama's day an old bummer.
Joe the Plumber. If you never knew why the sky is blue, or whatever happened to Jude Crew,
oh, I'm Joe the Plumber.
He's the average Joe, but with common sense. Call him on the phone or lean over his fence. Can you write him off as a business expense? Just ask Joe the Plumber. Joe. He's the guy in the very last row. He'll always make you think. Just don't let him near your sink. Joe the Plumber looms about as large as a hummer. Wish I'd known him back last summer. Joe the Plumber. Just ask Joe the Plumber. Just ask Joe the Plumber.
And his name, of course, isn't Joe. Ladies and gentlemen, now, news from outside the bubble. Well, just because I just got back from London on Friday night, I'm still up on this thing, and you'll see why it's might be important to share it. Aside from, as I noted on last week's show, it's few common elements with the Lance Armstrong affair. Not the behavior, but the reaction to it. Anyway, this is about the British disc jockey and former TV presenter, dead a year, and now revealed to have been a serial child sex abuser, Jimmy Savile. Detectives in Britain, this is from The Guardian, announced on Friday they were mounting a full criminal investigation after some of the hundreds of people who've come forward in response to the unfolding scandal made allegations they were abused by other individuals who are still alive, as well as the late Jimmy Savile. It's understood that, by the way, his headstone has already been removed from his grave. You know. It's understood that most of these claims of sexual abuse relate to people who were associated with Savile in some way. It's not known how many individuals are being investigated. Commander Peter Spindler from the Metropolitan Police, we call it Scotland Yard over here, said his officers were pursuing more than 400 lines of investigation. They've uncovered allegations against living people that require a formal criminal investigation. The National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children in Britain says it's now likely Savile was one of the most prolific sex offenders they've ever come across. We are dealing with alleged abuse on an unprecedented scale, said the police official. The profile of this operation has empowered a staggering number of victims to come forward to report the sexual exploitation which occurred during their childhood. Experts in cases of child abuse reported by adults many years later say arrests are likely to take place quickly. It's quite common that where one person is found to have committed child sex abuse in an institutional context, most likely a school, but also in hospitals, and now, as we've discovered at the BBC, it's usually a sign that the institution's child protection practices are inadequate, and it quite often happens that more than one person manages to take advantage of that, says Jonathan West, a leading child protection campaigner. But wait, there's more. A Sunday Telegraph investigation today, that's a British newspaper, reveals that the then Home Secretary, head of Health and Human Services in our government, the equivalent, appointed this selfsame Jimmy Savile to run a task force in charge of a hospital for disturbed and criminal children, or young people, in the 1980s, where he is accused of sexually assaulting patients. The task force he presided over was given temporary powers to oversee the running of the hospital following a series of industrial disputes, you know, labor actions, despite the fact that Savile, a disc jockey and television presenter, had no professional qualifications. I can run it. I liked kids. A friend of Savile's from his hometown in Leeds was then given the most senior job at the hospital. The BBC investigated a lurid sex scandal at Top of the Pops, the television program he hosted in the early 1970s, but never made the report public because it's public broadcasting. Savile was interviewed by the BBC as part of that inquiry, but refused to cooperate. Despite having no experience in mental health, Saville was given the job as chairman of the task force overseeing the Broadmoor facility. In 1988, after the hospital had been placed under the direct control of the Thatcher government following a series of strikes, you see. The health minister, Mrs. Curry, had responsibility for the country's high-security hospitals. Saville counted himself as a friend of Margaret Thatcher and reportedly stayed at Chequers, the equivalent of Camp David, on a number of occasions. Did she have children? Saville had long an association with Broadmoor Hospital, having been a volunteer worker there in the 1970s and 80s with the unofficial title Honorary Entertainment Officer. Shared that with you last week. He had his own set of keys and living quarters on the site. The former health minister said Saville met with her before the task force was appointed. She described his thoughts on the facility as, quote, intriguing. It's like John McCain and Joe Lieberman going to visit Muammar Gaddafi in 2008 and describing him as an interesting man. Among his intriguing insights, he told her he suspected staff were inflating their salary and he'd threatened to pass the information to the tabloid papers if the staff caused him any trouble. It does suggest, says the health minister, former health minister now in retrospect, that he was prepared to use blackmail to ensure people did what he wanted, unquote. Just a DJ. Just a radio kind of guy. More, a little bit more, from the Oxford Mail, Jimmy Saville was a Peter Pan-like figure. Where have we heard that before? I think now there must be a presumption that anybody who uses the Peter Pan analogy needs immediate medical and or police attention. He was a Peter Pan-like figure who saw himself as the same age as his alleged victims, according to a former BBC producer, David Winter, who was also a former Oxfordshire priest, worked with Saville in the 1970s, and said he liked having young girls around him. He described Saville as a creepy and unwholesome person who never stopped his stage act, but he never suspected the DJ of sexually abusing girls. Saville, a devout Roman Catholic, had told him he would use his charity week to get into heaven if he was deemed immoral by St. Peter. Counting on St. Peter to have really precise accountancy skills. Now, on a related subject, you probably heard that the Boy Scouts of America released voluminous files this week in response to court orders about a history of child sexual abuse in the Scouts. In the Scouts, ladies and gentlemen, who could have imagined? And that's the Scouts had wanted for many, tried for many years to keep those files from being disclosed publicly because they said it would discourage victims from coming forward. Yeah, it gets you right here. I don't know where your here is. But this from outside the bubble. Scouts are on top of it overseas. From the Telegraph in Britain, the British Boy Scout Association wants to curb the use of nicknames by its members because it believes they lead to bullying. Leaders are being given training sessions in which they're encouraged not to use nicknames for one another, these would be adults, in quotes, or for the children because the youngsters might copy their behavior and be more likely to use the nicknames among themselves. The irony here is that the founder of the Boy Scouts movement, it's a movement, Lord Baden-Powell, had many nicknames. He's still known as BP, not only his initials, but those of its motto, Be Prepared. But at school, he was called Bathing Towel. The Baden-Powell, Bathing Towel, a nickname which stuck to him in later life. News from outside the bubble, ladies. Bathing Towel. Couldn't have a double meaning. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
The woman I love is not as pretty as the one over there, the one making eyes at me, but I don't even care. That's 'cause I know. Yes, that's 'cause I know. I know a good man doesn't let a short-term gain mess up a long-time thing. Oh, wait, there's more. The woman I love is not as rich as the one down the street. She can flash her cash, it won't interest me. That's 'cause I know. Yes, that's 'cause I know. I know a good man doesn't let a short-term gain mess up a long-time thing. You gotta know that so. I hate to say it, but I see it way too often. A man might as well be pounding nails in his own coffin. The short-term gain will soon put him down, and then he'll see his long-term thing no longer around. But there's all these young women, mine getting older by the day. I'm not interested, I know experience pays. That's 'cause I know. Yes, that's 'cause I know. I know a good man doesn't let a short-term gain mess up a long-time thing. Now I gotta go, gotta get back to that woman of mine.
This is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Deadline Garland, Texas. A Dallas area middle school band has received an apology after being silenced by a referee for playing during a football game. Officials say the Hudson Middle School band was flagged by the referee while playing Jackson, another school in the same district. District spokesman Chris Moore said the referee threw a flag before halftime and warned that Hudson would be penalized if the music continued. Moore says the band director decided the students should leave. Moore doesn't know what prompted the flag and says Jackson's coach had not complained. Not enough music during athletic events anyway, ladies and gentlemen. The Tasmanian government's adoption policies, forced in the past, have affected tens of thousands of people in the island state of Australia. A recent report found that political leaders have now owed an apology to all of them for their sufferings. Premier Laura Giddings was in tears while the apology was being tendered to the Parliament House in Hobart. Hundreds of people had gathered there, and the leaders bowed down in front of all of them. The report finds that a massive number of children were not allowed to be grown up with care and love of their parents. All of them, however, have now become adults, and the leaders also apologized to all of them. Daily New York, J.P. Morgan Chase and Company has apologized. To the U.S. energy regulator this week for providing misleading information about California electricity markets, saying it was inadvertent. The bank also urged the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission not to follow through on the threat to suspend its market-based rate authority, which would force it to sell power at a significantly lower rate and would probably drive it out of the market. The regulator has said the bank broke the law, that's all. Oh, the law! That applies to... by submitting misleading information to the commission and to the California grid operator. Isn't that what Enron did? It worked with then. The commission's latest probe comes on the heels of a separate lawsuit in which it has accused J.P. Morgan of bidding up electricity prices in California and the Midwest. J.P. Morgan Chase said any omission of facts was inadvertent and contended it should not be penalized with revocation of the ability to profitably trade in electricity markets. That would be a conditional apology if I ever heard of one. The aforementioned Boy Scouts of America this week apologized to victims of abuse and their families and said it has enhanced its policies for protecting children. Correcting them might be better, but it's enhanced them. After the release of those long secret documents by an attorney in Portland, the organization called the files a key method used to keep scouts safe by recording the activities of what it calls ineligible volunteers. Enough said. The Arizona Daily Wildcat, the student-run daily newspaper at the University of Arizona, has issued an apology and fired the cartoonist after publishing an editorial cartoon that critics said advocated violence against lesbian and gay people. In the apology, editor Christina Bui, wrote that the Daily Wildcat staff made a serious error in judgment in printing a cartoon that some readers felt was homophobic and inappropriate. The cartoon by student D.C. Parsons was published Tuesday, featured a father telling his young son, "If you ever tell me you're gay, I will shoot you with my shotgun, roll you up in a carpet, and throw you off of a bridge," unquote. Parsons has also apologized and wrote that the comic was not intended to offend. "It was based on an experience from my childhood. My father is a devout conservative from a previous generation, and I believe he was simply distraught from the fact that I had learned from The Simpsons what homosexuality was at such a young age." You're welcome, babe. You are so welcome. Deadline, Changwon, South Korea. Ruling party presidential candidate Park Geun-hye this week offered condolences to the victims of a 1979 democracy uprising in what appeared to be another move to shed the historical baggage led by the authoritarian rule of her late father, President Park Chung-hee. Last month, the 60-year-old standard-bearer of the conservative Sinuri Party apologized to all those who suffered under her father's repressive regime as pressure mounted on her to acknowledge the country's turbulent past. Turbulent, you see. For years, she had been regarded as being in denial. After she made the apology in her news conference, her falling public approval ratings began to climb once more. "I offer my deep condolences to the victims and family members of those who sacrificed themselves and suffered harm for democratization," she said at the launching of a campaign headquarters. Just the place for an apology. Dateline Vatican City, Cardinal Peter Turkson, president of Vatican's Pontifical Council on Peace and Justice, has apologized for rankling brother bishops with a video making alarmist predictions about the growth of Islam in Europe. That's nice. How about time for another crusade, do you think? South Korea's defense chief apologized publicly and dismissed three officers this week after his military failed to spot a North Korean soldier defecting to the south across their supposedly heavily guarded border. The Australian Red Cross has apologized after posting homophobic comments on Facebook claiming all gays engage in risky behavior. That's a quote. The organization told News Limited, owned by Rupert Murdoch, that the remarks about blood donation, which were made in reply to a user's accusation of homophobia, were made in error by a busy employee. It's just being too busy. British police apologized this week for using a stun gun to subdue a blind stroke victim they wrongly thought was carrying a samurai sword, a bizarre case, I'll say, of mistaken identity that left the man fearing for his life. The head of a French state-run television channel apologized this week for using last year's Fouque disaster to make fun of a soccer goalkeeper. U.S. Ambassador to Japan John Roos has apologized for the latest incident in Okinawa where two U.S. servicemen were arrested on suspicion of raping a Japanese woman. The captain, who's blamed for the Costa Concordia disaster at sea earlier this year, apologized and shook hands with survivors in court on Monday. Rupert Murdoch has apologized to Hugh Grant after suggesting that the British actor had abandoned his baby daughter. The News Corp boss expressed his regret in his comments on Twitter after accepting that the star was closely involved in his child's life, according to the Daily Telegraph. He also called celebrities who've been meeting with a phone hacking task force scumbag celebrities and apologized for that as well. Nice verbiage, Roop. Former Obama aide we referred to her earlier Neera Tanden took to Twitter to apologize for some choice words she uttered about her former boss. In an interview with New York Magazine, she'd been trying to explain why Obama didn't call former President Clinton for the first 2 years of its administration. People say the reason Obama wouldn't call Clinton is because he didn't like him. The truth is, Obama doesn't call anyone, and he's not close to almost anyone. It's stunning he's in politics because he really doesn't like people. She suggested in her mea culpa, it was a poor choice of words. I was trying to say how President Obama, whom I admire greatly, is a private person, but I deeply regret how I said it. I apologize, she wrote. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. You know that Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, has now officially taken responsibility for the disaster at the disastrous attack of the Benghazi U.S. consulate in Libya that resulted in the deaths of four Americans, including our ambassador. She took responsibility after a political ruckus developed over the whether the administration had originally blamed the attacks as a reaction on a crowd reaction to that fake anti-Muslim film, unquote, or whether it was a terrorist event. Meanwhile, as they say in the news business, former President Clinton said Friday that President Obama is facing a tough re-election race because, quote, impatient, unquote, Americans haven't fully recognized the economy's on the mend. He said voters should judge Obama on the past 3 years in which private sector job growth has made up for lost ground. This shouldn't be a race. He said the only reason is because Americans are impatient on things not made before yesterday, and they don't understand why the economy is not totally hunky-dory again. Unquote. Maybe. Maybe not maybe. There's another edition of Clinton Something next here on the show.
Clinton Something, the State Department years.
Thanks for making the time to us. I mean, Madam Secretary.
No problem, Bill. I was between Syria meetings at the UN, so...
Kind of brings back memories, just you and me having dinner here.
Just watching myself sign my last name brings back memories, but yeah. This is always nice.
Good evening. Welcome to the Four Seasons.
Thanks.
Tonight's menu is based on autumn. Let me know if you have any questions.
Thanks.
My first question would have been, what season do you think we were expecting in mid-October?
Yeah, right. You know, you don't have to charm me. I already know you.
So, look, hon, I just thought we should celebrate the fact that we got something in common again.
Oh, namely?
We're both spending our time picking up poop for the big guy.
In a way.
I mean, I had to cancel a trip to Haiti so I could go do my speech blaming the voters for impatience about the economy.
Haiti? Still?
Mm-hmm. Donor to the foundation has plans for a project that could really help with the unemployment down there.
What's that?
A 5-star resort with 3 championship 18-hole golf courses. He's already got the name for it and everything. Resurrection Village, except Resurrection is pronounced like it's in French.
I get it. Well, maybe they can sell It Takes a Village in the gift shop.
You don't have to charm me either.
Got it. Well, but, so you made the speech?
First in a series. Mm-hmm. Americans are too impatient to understand how much this guy's accomplished. You know, we're a fast food nation, an ADHD society.
Test well?
It did okay. Of course, they don't test it with me reading it. You know, that'd be like hearing Larry King sing a Dylan. But, man, he's got you taking a bullet big time.
It's not the weirdest thing in the world for a cabinet secretary to step up and take responsibility for a mistake made at another level.
Artfully phrased. What is weird is taking responsibility for a mistake made at a higher level.
I'm thinking about having the char.
The what?
The Arctic char.
Hey, might as well. Pretty soon the Arctic's going to be the next energy ocean.
I have to say, your writers are getting better and better.
Mm-hmm. But just how did that go down? Madam Secretary, blaming the CIA for the mess over the Libya attack isn't working. We need something new and fresh to blame. Any ideas?
What looks good to you?
You really don't want me to answer that question.
On the menu.
So my question is, which of us humiliated ourselves more? I'd say me, you know, for insulting the voters who put me in office twice, but that's just me.
You're right there. Look, Bill, I wouldn't be Secretary of State if it weren't for this guy.
That's right. You'd be president.
And you would be legally constrained from enjoying large and untraceable sources of income. So...
No, I love this guy. I'm just saying...
So have we made the choice yet?
Yeah, I think I was the most humiliated, but...
I'd come back.
And intel on the Benghazi attack was sketchy.
Hey, hon. George Bush skated on the CIA's back for 7 years. The CIA's there to be blamed. That's the price for getting to play all the really cool games.
I'm just saying that when there's no penalty attached to it, taking responsibility for a mistake on your watch can sometimes goose the gravitas number. It has.
So the CIA owes you one?
I've got a little book of who owes me.
Print is so not dead.
Would you like me to bring you a printed menu, sir?
No. The iPad's fine. Just give us another minute. You don't need this table, do you?
As a matter of fact, Mr. Moonves has it booked for 9.
And he's still president of something. We'll just be a minute.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Look, hon, neither of us is humiliated. If the big guy gets back in, it's 4 more years before you've got competition on the big money do-gooder circuit.
If you don't count Tony Blair. Touche.
Next time you give that speech blaming the voters, just... keep whispering to yourself, Davos, Davos, Davos. Okay?
Okay.
Youthful angst and middle-aged power. Together they add up to Clinton something, the State Department years.
Transcribed. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of News Corp. Nice people doing nice things.
Well,
this is the age of accountability, don't you know, where people are called to account for their actions, whether in high positions, high in society or low. You know that, and I know that, because Deadline London, former newspaper executive Rebecca Brooks, who was forced out of her job, you may recall, because she was linked and now has been criminally charged in the phone hacking scandal at the Nice Corp-owned newspaper, the News of the World. That Rebecca Brooks, she's received a payoff totaling $11.2 million following her scuttling away from the British newspaper group last year. An $11 million golden goodbye. That is so nice. Because, you know, they're not that... they have a new business model. Brooks, the woman at the heart of the scandal, shaking Rupert Murdoch's media empire and the British government, is awaiting trial next year on multiple charges in relation to phone hacking by reporters in one of her papers. The Financial Times, not owned by Rupert Murdoch, cites two people with knowledge of her compensation is saying the payoff consisted of cash, that's kind of untraceable, and pension payments, as well as an allowance for legal fees and the use of a chauffeur-driven car. That is so nice. Two of the people cited by the newspaper said the payoff also included substantial clawback clauses for her former employer News, Nice Corp. These entitled Nice International, the British arm of Nice Corp, to recover some of the payments from Brooks in certain circumstances. Those would be, I guess, if she's found guilty. So that's why they're paying for a good lawyer. If you ask me, that's nice. Nice people doing nice things. One of these days, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think I've ever explained on the air where that phrase came from. It's worth meeting me. And now, a little follow-up on something the host of this program has been talking about for a couple of years. You know that I've said more than once on this broadcast, apropos of the screening process at U.S. airports administered by the Transportation Safety Administration, pat-down is for now, radiation is forever. Well, maybe not forever. The Transportation Safety Administration, Security Administration, has been quietly removing X-ray body scanners from major airports over the last few weeks and replacing them with machines that radiation experts believe are safer. This according to ProPublica. The TSA says it made the decision not because of safety concerns, but to speed up checkpoints at busier airports because they've been so concerned with that for so many years. It does mean that far fewer passengers will be exposed to radiation because the X-ray scanners are being moved to smaller airports. The backscatters, as the X-ray scanners are known, were swapped out at Boston in early October. Similar replacements have occurred at LAX, Chicago O'Hare, Orlando, and JFK. That's been confirmed by the TSA. The X-ray scanners faced a barrage of criticism since the TSA began rolling them out nationwide after the failed underwear bombing on Christmas Day 2009. They emit a small dose of ionizing radiation, which at higher levels has been proven to cause cancer. In addition, of course, there was the whole privacy thing. They're not all being replaced, says TSA spokesman David Castelviter. It's being done strategically. We're replacing some of the older equipment and taking them to smaller airports, he says. So the TSA decided to move the X-ray machines to less busy airports after conducting an analysis of processing time and staffing requirements at the airports where the scanners are installed. Would that include the staff required to keep them properly calibrated? Radiation risk and privacy concerns had no bearing on the decision, said the spokesperson. Asked about the changes, John Terrell, a spokesman for Rapiscan, which makes the X-ray scanners, wrote in an email, quote, "No comment on this," unquote. Former Homeland Security Chief Mike Chertoff was a lobbyist for Rapiscan at the time, or shortly before the TSA arranged to buy these machines at $150K per, I think that's the price. They're not phasing out X-ray body scanners altogether. They're still being used for screening at a few of America's largest 25 airports. TSA has not confirmed which ones. But a small airport, Gateway, in Mesa, Arizona, installed two of the machines. The United States remains one of the only countries in the world to X-ray passengers for airport screening. The European Union prohibited the backscatters last year, quote, in order not to risk jeopardizing citizens' health and safety. So, the guy who said, "Don't touch my junk," may not need to say that any longer, and neither may this guy.
Well, I'm the straightest dude you'll find this side of NASCAR. I only kissed a man when I was drunk. But if I have to fly to Vegas or Madagascar, well,
come on, baby, you can touch my junk. Come on, baby, you can touch my junk.
My clothes don't draw the least bit of attention. No old baseball scorecards are all that fill my trunk. But if you have to feel me up to earn your pension, I say,
come on. Can touch my junk. Oh, yes, sir, darling, you can touch my junk.
You want to do some fishing? That's just what I've been wishing. Got a fishing hole that's aching for a friend. Let my eyes do the talking while your fingers do the walking, and we might meet again right around the bend. My wife and kids will tell you I'm no swinger. More into classic rock than bounce or crunk. But the disco ball's here if you make me linger.
Come on, girls, step up and touch my junk. Oh, come on, girls, take a chance and touch my junk.
That protest bit is just a pile of bunk. In that uniform, you're 18 kinds of hunk. So if what you're craving is an enhanced spelunk.
Oh, come on, baby, just touch my junk. just touch my junk. Come on, come on, come on and touch my junk.
News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen. Three female plaintiffs claim in a lawsuit that an evangelical church group, covered up allegations of sexual abuse against children. It's spreading. The suit filed this week in state court in Maryland alleges that Sovereign Grace Ministries failed to protect children from being sexually abused by church members. The alleged incidents date back to the mid-1980s in Maryland and Northern Virginia. The plaintiffs claim church leaders did not report allegations of misconduct to the police and offered legal advice to suspected pedophiles. The church said in a statement that it had not yet seen the suit and couldn't comment, but it said it considers child abuse reprehensible and criminal. Sovereign Grace Ministries was founded and all the way back in 1982 has more than 80 churches around the world. You know, part of me wonders if, let's say it this way, recalls that there was a spate of allegations of satanic rituals involving children in the late 1980s, whipped up by, among other people, Geraldo Rivera. My intuition is this is not that. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world via the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, and all the rest. If you're in the Los Angeles area and you're a fan of Richard Thompson, Judith Owen, or myself, or Danny Thompson, we're all participating in a fabulous show written by Richard Thompson next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica. You'll hear some incredible music, and you'll get to see the home of the homeless for yourself. Word of the wise. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. This broadcast is represented on Twitter. Join the more than 74,000 wise followers at the Harry Shearer. The email address for this broadcast, the playlist of the music heard here on, and schedule of all my upcoming live shows, including tomorrow night at the Grammy Museum and November 23rd in London at Under the Bridge, all available and so much more at harryshearer.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless.